did the first track. But the reason is that the Manx Grand Prix has been on, and of course bikes lodging around here and all have been dashing up and down, and they make an awful noise. In the microphone they sound like an electric sewing machine with an amplifier on. However, that's all over now, so perhaps we'll continue with the lobster pot story. Well, as I said, we tied all the claws of the lobsters. They were brought back to the beach, well, not exactly the beach, to a big store pot, an ordinary lobster pot about four times the size of the normal ones we catch them in. This was anchored about 100 yards off the beach, 100 yards below low water mark, of course. And into this all the lobsters were put, because they only shipped off to Klux's every Tuesday and Friday, you see, and so they were kept alive in the store pot and lifted every Tuesday morning first thing and sent off, and every Friday morning first thing sent off. But they were quite pricey those days too. If I remember rightly, we used to get, at least my grandpa used to get them, saying we as though I was getting it, we used to get 16 shillings a stone, 16 shillings old money, of course. And that was quite a bit of money, those, 16 bob a stone live weight, you know, because it doesn't take much to make a stone of lobsters. However, finishing with the lobsters, we used to get an awful lot of crabs in the pots. Well, these didn't seem to be of any value. The fishmongers didn't want to know, and we'd sell them off to the locals and to the visitors, about 12 on a string for a shilling. And of course, we kept a lot ourselves, too. We often lit a fire on the beach and hung a galvanized bucket over it and boiled a couple of dozen crabs in it. Well, you had a good feed with some bread and butter, because very often we had to eat on the beach. There wasn't time to go home in between going to do one job and another. But the crabs were very good feed. I was very fond of them. I was very fond of them yet, too, to be quite honest. And I like a good crab. And although my eyes are still bad, I can still dress a crab and take the old dead man's fingers out and open the purse and dress it up as good as any fishmonger. Oh, we've had many a tasty feed of crabs, you know, but they're very pricey now, to what they used to be anyway. A conger was a menace to get in the pots, because you couldn't put your hand in to get them out, you know. And if they only had the common sense, they could have got out themselves quite easy. If they put their heads up and into the opening they came in through, they could have easy enough squirmed out. But they never seemed to be able to do that. They just went round and round inside the pot. But we always carried a small trident, a thing like you used to see on the back of an old penny, with Britannia sitting holding the barbed, little three-pronged barbed thing. And the only way was to get that down in the pot and plunge it through the conger so that he couldn't get off, and then haul him out of the pot and kill him in the usual way. He, of course, went on the slab and was chopped up for lobster bait. Well, I think that's all about the lobsters, so now we'll go on with the seine net fishing. Spelt S-E-I-N-E, actually, not S-A-N-E. The seine netting was done from Laxey Beach. Of course, Laxey Beach then was a different proposition to what it is now. It was one long stretch of silvery coloured sand. Now it's all stones and pebbles, I believe. The sand came right up to the roadway, which is now the promenade. It was only a rough road in those days. There was no promenade. And there was grand fish on that beach too. And it was a wonderful beach for bathing and everything. But now they tell me there's only a little bit of sand seen at dead low water. I don't know what happened to it. The scientists say, of course, it's the movement of the earth and all. But my own theory is that it's since the mines closed down, because there must have been thousands and thousands and thousands of tons, hundreds of thousands of tons of sand come down that river from the washing floor of the mines. But the scientists say not, so they know best. But that's my own pet theory. However, as I say, it was all sand and a wonderful fishing ground. Now, the method of the seine netting was, the net was very similar to the salmon net, not so wide, it was 6 feet, with the usual weights on the bottom and floats on the tops, but no anchorage at either end. The boat came back into the beach, and a rope was put ashore. Well, then the boat went out, say, about 300 to 400 yards, I should think it would be. This was always done practically on high water. Well, when they came to the end of the rope, they turned at right angles and started shooting the net, running parallel with the beach. The net would be 250, maybe 300 yards long. And when they came to the end of that, they turned at right angles into the beach again with another rope. Well, as I said, the net was almost similar to the salmon net, only it had what we called a cod end in the middle. This was like a huge bulge in the net, like a bag. And when the two ropes were ashore, well, one rope was left ashore and the other was brought ashore, well, it took about three men on each rope to haul them in, and with a lad to tail the rope, as we called it. Well, I tailed one end and the younger cousin of mine tailed the other. Because on this rope was marks. They were little bits of canvas put in through the lay of the rope about every 4 or 5 fathom, I would think. Well, the men started hauling, and the two lads, me and my cousin, coiled, and as the marks came in, we shouted them. Well, at the other end, if they hadn't got to their mark, we waited until they called theirs, so as the net came in evenly. And of course, it was all bottom fish we were after. All prime stuff, of course. Clukes wouldn't have any rubbish, and of course we never thought to send them any rubbish. Large place, quite big turbot, sole. We didn't get many soles, but we got a few. Skate, and of course we got plenty of other small fish in the net, but they were thrown back in the sea immediately they were landed to let them grow on a bit. The mesh was about 1.5 inches, I think, so the likes of whiting and stuff could escape through it. But as I said previously, getting help for crewing was a bit hard during the war, but Laxey Mines, of course, they were at full pressure during the war, and they worked two shifts, if I remember rightly. Well, my grandpa could always get two or three of the miners to come and give a hand with the seine netting, because when they were off shift, of course, because it could be quite a profitable night or day or whatever it was for them. I mean, everything was worked in shares. The owner took a share, there was a share for the boat and gear, which of course also belonged to the owner, and then every man got a share, and the two lads got a man's share between them. Well, many a night or daytime, whenever we were seen, and I've had 10 or 15 bob, which was quite a lot for a kid my age. Well, the men hauled and hauled on the ropes until the net was dragged right in the shore, right up onto the beach, and in the cod end, all the fish would be. Well, this was unlaced pretty quickly onto the sand, onto the dry sand, and all the small stuff was sorted as quickly as possible and thrown back in the sea, and the prime stuff, of course, was put into boxes. And if we had time and the sea was not too high or any way lumpy, we'd do another seine, because both sets of ropes had already been coiled, you see, and it was only a matter of whipping out with the boat and shooting the net again and doing another seine. Well, each one took about a couple hours, I would say. So if you got, a man got a pound or 30 bob for that, he wasn't badly paid. And they all took my grandfather's word. He marketed the fish, of course, and then he paid them when he got paid from the fishmonger. And they all took his word for it. He was honest as the day is long. Just deviating again for a minute or two, I've been thinking back to my theory of the sand on Laxey Beach coming from the Laxey Mine. Now, Laxey Mine was opened, I think, in about 1854. And I don't think it closed till somewhere near the mid-20s. So during that time, I said, thousands of tons of sand must have been washed down that river. There must have been millions of tons in that odd 70 years. And apart from that, Snaefell Mine was going for a long time too, until the disaster. I think that was about 1911. And there must have been sand coming down from that, off the washing floors. So, and the sand in Laxey had a bright streak to it, you know. It was quite bright sand. And of course, the name Laxey, in the old Scandinavian translation, means river of silver or river of lead. There's two schools of thought on that. Also, I heard it was once called the river of salmon, but I asked a very old Manxman over this, and he just laughed at me and said, have you ever seen a salmon in Laxey River? So I had to admit I hadn't. Well, Well, I think I've given you a fairly full account of the prime fishing, as I would call it. You know, the really good fish, and now we get to the run-of-the-mill stuff. Cod, mackerel, etc. Well, there wasn't a lot of money in the cod or mackerel, you know. They were the cheap kind of fish. But they were hard enough work getting them. But of course, the Skluksa took all our catch, and they depended on us getting some of these fish for them. Well, of course, we had to do it. Well, the cod lines were purely and simply what we call long lines. We set them a weight at the bottom and a mollock at the top, and maybe 200 yards of line in between with a cast on about every fathom and hook baited, of course. Well, of course, these all had to be prepared before we left the shore on the creel so that the hooks had to be placed, baited and placed, so that when you start to shoot the line, they went out without snagging on the side of the boat or anything like that. But there was no money in cod. Maybe sixpence, you'd get a good cod for sixpence those days. And the mackerel itself, that was much harder work. Well, Klux expect us to send about anything from 10 dozen to 20 dozen every morning into them. And with a couple of hand lines and the old mourner being rowed, well, it sounds a lot of fish, really, but when you got in the shoal, which could be anything from 3 or 4 miles, 5 miles long to a mile wide, when you got in the shoal, you weren't long picking up 120 or 200 mackerel, you know. But, as I say, it was hard work, heavy rowing, and hard going with the lines, and you went out a long way for the mackerel. Well, about 4 miles, 4 to 5 miles, I think, because when you go out from Garwick and you can see Mackerel Lighthouse and Douglas Lighthouse, you're out about 4 miles. And when you can see Langness and Point of Ayre, you're out about 7 to 8, I think, if I can remember rightly. Mind you, if we had the lug sail on the morning, it wasn't so bad, but if there was no wind or the wind wasn't fair, as I said before, she wouldn't sail very close to the wind or anything. It was heavy going, rowing a couple of 12-foot sweeps and fishing at the same time with two hand lines with 6-pound weights on them. But, as I say, Klooks is depended on them, so we used to send as much as we could every morning. Well, every morning, my grandmother came down to the beach with the pony cart. He had a flat spring cart, an old Icelandic pony named Tommy, a lovely-looking pony, a yellowy, sulfury colour. My word, he was a nice-looking horse, but old Tommy trotted off to Douglas every morning, my grandmother there with the fish boxes in, and unloaded to the back of Klooks's, then came home again. If she'd fiddle a shilling or two for the mackerel on the way, well, she'd have a tot of rum on the way back at the halfway house or the Manx Arms. But as I say, there was no price for them. I think about a shilling a dozen we used to get from Klooks's for them. Shilling old money, that was a penny each. One of the old pennies, of course. Of course, now I don't know what price they are now, but they're quite pricey, the same as everything else. Of course, when we got Kitty, it made life a bit easier on the mackerel fishing. So I think that's about all the fishing I've got to tell you about now, so when I record again, I'll tell you the story of Kitty. Well, I told you a little bit about Kitty at the beginning of this tape, a beam and general dimensions and construction, which was double diagonal. But on second thoughts, I'd better explain that double diagonal construction. Well, instead of the planking running fore and aft as normal, the planking ran upright from the keel up to the deck line, running with the rake of the bow, right down to the stern. And inside that, there was another set of planking which ran in exactly the opposite direction, hence the double diagonal. A very, very sound method of construction. But as Kitty was an ex-lifeboat, I suppose that was the idea of it in the first place. She was, I think, the ex-Whitehaven lifeboat and had been bought by a gentleman before the war for cruising around the estuaries and rivers and canals, just close-in stuff. There was traces that she'd had a small, very small motor, auxiliary motor, because on the port side under the stern there was a patch on her sheathing and traces of an air bracket there, which looked as though a propeller shaft had been mounted there. But if she had a small engine, it must have been mounted in the cockpit, because there was quite a large cabin on it. She was beautifully decked in quite a large cabin. This cabin was very well appointed. There were four berths in it, with plenty of locker space under the lower berths, plenty of headroom. Well, of course, it was raised above the deck quite a bit, about 14 inches, I would say, and two skylights. High skylights they were, not dead lights. You could open them in fine weather and batten them down, of course, in bad weather. Well, just far out of the cabin, there was a small forecastle with two berths in it, quite small ones, but one was big enough for me, and a small cooking stove. Coal, of course. There was no oil or Keller gas stoves those days. And we carried a small quantity of coal in one of the lockers underneath one of the little forecastle berths for when we did a bit of cooking on board. We'd no idea how she'd been rigged because there was no bowsprit or housing for a bowsprit, and the men were stepped really well forward. In fact, it was a mast you could lower those heel there for it. Of course, there was no spars of any kind, mast or any kind of board when we took her over. And I think she only carried either a big lug sail or a big mainsail, because, as I said before, she was only for cruising around the estuaries and close inshore and up the canals and all. And I suppose the idea of lowering the mainmast was to go underneath canal bridges. And I often think now, afterwards, a year or two afterwards, when we came into Douglas Harbour, the engineer on the swing bridge always used to give us a cheery smile and a wave, because we could lower the mainmast and slip underneath the swing bridge without him having to open it. Anyway, we took her over as a hulk almost, although she was a solid hulk. And Mr. Callow, a friend of my grandfather's from Douglas, Mr. James Callow, he took us out in the Eagle, a big motor yacht he had, and we went to Maryport and got the Kitty in tow and towed her back to Douglas Harbour to await the high tide when we could bring her into Gawick and draw her up the beach for a refit. Well, the biggest tide of the winter was somewhere about mid-December 1918. Mind the war had been over since 11th of November, and things had started to get back to normal again. Anyway, a lot of preparation had to be made on the beach first. First of all, there was a bit of a slipway made of some old railway sleepers that we had, and we were going to use the winch and a big four-fold purchase, or great big blocks that they use like in lifting the derricks of the big merchantmen. Well, my grandfather had borrowed these from Mr. Farragher, who had a boatyard on the Tongue at that time. Well, the winch was not in line with where we wanted to pull Kitty up, so in line where she had to go, there was a 3-foot steel crowbar driven right down into the shingle for the sledgehammer, and to this snatch block was shackled. And then right in front of the winch itself was another crowbar driven in with another snatch block to it. And the winch wire was led through that and through the other snatch block that made a gun tackle purchase, which made it a bit, it would make it a bit easier to pull up. The four-fold purchase was reeved off with about 60 fathom of new manila rope bought from Quiggin and Company, who specialised in making rope then. Of course, there was no nylon those days. I think it'd be about 3-inch, maybe 3.5 or 4-inch rope. It was fairly heavy. Of course, rope is measured by circumference, not diameter. This was securely shackled to a big sycamore tree. It's just shackled with a big wire hawser. And the sycamore tree was right in line where we wanted the boat to come up, and then everything was ready. Well, the next thing was to wait for the high tide. Well, that high tide happened to fall on a Sunday. Well, as I've said in previous tapes, Sunday was the Sabbath day then, and some of the church and chapel dignitaries looked askance a bit that my grandfather bringing the boat home and expecting to haul up the beach on the Sunday. But his very good friend Canon Quine, Vicar of London, he said the harvest of the sea was just as important as the harvest of the land, and that turned the tables. A lot of the farmers' men came down, the farmers themselves, and several of the Laxey miners all were there to bear a hand. I think it all would be a score or 25 of good men there, good strong men. Well, the high tide, I think, was about 1:30, and Albert, my grandfather, and me set off Douglas I think it was on about 10 o'clock car. There was cars on a Sunday then. There isn't now, of course. And Mr. Caller and his mate got the Eagle ready, and we got Kitty in tow, and off we set for Garwick. Well, we got round the Stall Point into Garwick Bay about or best part of an hour before the full flood. So Eagle cast us loose and came round and manoeuvred in against the stern, and we got our bow snugged very snugly against Kitty's stern. Of course, Kitty hadn't the normal stern. She was a lifeboat, as I said before, and had a pointed stern, so Eagle's bow was snubbed in quite nicely alongside that, and she started to ease us in toward the beach. Of course, Eagle couldn't take us in all the way because she drew a lot more water than we did. She was built on yacht lines with a deep keel. But about 40 or 50 fathom off the beach, we dropped a kedge anchor astern. A couple of boatmen came out in one of the pleasure boats, bringing a line with them. This we took aboard, and attached that was the winch wire, which we heaved in, made fast up forward, and the boys on the winch tightened up a little bit. We paid out the kedge. Eagle cast off, went astern, and gave us a cheery wave and a shout of good luck, and headed back for Douglas. As the tide flooded, well, the winch was gradually tightened and the kedge was paid out, and when we reached the top of the flood, Kitty's forefoot was resting neatly on the first sleeper of the slipway we'd made. I forgot to mention, too, that it was a beautiful day for mid-December. The sea was like a sheet of glass, and I think what's reminded me of it is the Force 9 sou'wester that's blowing outside. You might hear some of the background noise of it over the mic, I don't know. Anyway, we got her all fast there on the slipway, and then the next job was to get the ballast out of her. Well, we'd already lifted the deck planking in the forecastle cabin and cockpit that gave access to the bilges, and a couple of fellas came aboard in over the bow. Of course, her stern was still afloat. Garwick beat shells quite steeply, you know. And they started unloading these half hundredweight pigs of iron from the bow downwards, you see, and passed them down through, and the other fellas dropped them overboard. Of course, I was too small and young to be able to handle those things, but as they took them out of the bow, of course, Kitty's stern went a bit steeper in the water and lifted the bow, and the men on the winch took a turn too, and that bow slipped up onto the slipway quite a bit before we had it all unloaded. This ballast, of course, had to be shifted later on up to above high water mark on the beach. Well, the ballast was all out. The tide went back and Kitty was left there high and dry. Well, then the winch tackle was taken off her and shackled up to a ring and hook and hole in her forefoot, which evidently had been there when she was a lifeboat for taking up and down the slipway. And the fourfold purchase, a big hawser was put right round above her belting. The rudder had been unshipped, right round above her belting, and a few bits of sack on to prevent chafing. And then the fourfold purchase was shackled onto that. And then it was a case of all hands to heave. Well, I think to be about eight men on the purchase. There was about four on the winch, and the rest were alongside her with their shoulders under the belting, keeping her upright. And of course then the word came to heave ho. Well, in the middle of this, Canon Quine came down to the beach, complete in clerical hat and coat. Anyway, off came his coat and hat, and he bore a hand on the fourfold purchase tackle. My gum good strong man he was too. Anyway, the boys heaved and heaved, and gradually Kitty went up and up, you know, but a foot at a time. And in about or three quarters of an hour, maybe an hour, she was up home and dry where she had to lie for the winter for her refit. Well, chocks were put under her bilge keels, or rolling chocks, and a couple of legs were bolted to her sides to keep her upright, and that was the day done. Well, there was no pay, of course, for this kind of job. It was just a neighbourly good turn, as was always seemed to be done those days. But I heard me grandpa telling all of them that if they cared to meet him in the halfway house or to give it his right name, the Liverpool Arms Hotel, the next night about 8 o'clock, the drinks would be on him. Of course, had it been summertime, there'd have been a Garrett Glen Hotel, but that only held a summer license, May to September, I think, those days. Anyway, that was one party I wasn't allowed to attend, naturally. Well, Kitty's refit started in real earnest. She was scrubbed from stem to stern, cleaned up, decks were wholly stoned, and then the leg was taken away from the port side, and she was careened over, and the painting started on her. Well, she was copper sheathed on the bottom. I don't know whether I mentioned that or not. Well, that was all given a good scrub and a coat of red lead, and then painted up in a very, very dark green right up to her boot topping. On top of that, there was a white hull up to her belting, which was painted a very dark raven red, and then up to the bulwarks, it was white again. The engine room, or cabin as it used to be, it's now converted to an engine room. I'll tell you about that later. That was painted white and all, and the decks were wholly stone till the, oh my word, the, you could eat your dinner off them. Then she was careened over onto the starboard side, and the same done the other side with the painting. Now she was tiller steered. Well, that of course was no use, because it was in the road of the fishing. This problem was handed over to Mr. Tom Kane, the local blacksmith. Well, he was more than a blacksmith, he was a craftsman in iron or steel or anything like that. Well, he fixed up a wheel just on the port side by the engine room. He just stood on the grating and could see over the engine room roof, and with a series of gears and rods and things like that, all beautifully concealed. Even the quadrant was only half on the rod ahead, it was on the port side, and you could get a full starboard or port helm on it. And it was all so beautifully done that you couldn't find it, all concealed underneath the combings of the cockpit. And he made a grand job of it. Also, at the same time, he put rails. We had bulwarks up to about 10 inches, and on top of them he put a set of rails which went up about another 18 inches for safety. My grandfather's safety maxims again coming out. On the port side, they went right from the bow to the stern. But on the starboard side, they finished at the break of the engine room, or cabin as it was. So that left us the whole of the starboard side and the whole of the stern clear for fishing. Mr. Tom Kane really was an expert at these things. And men like him aren't in existence now. I was just thinking, you must be wondering, by the way, why I'm at the school. But after World War I, as lots of people will remember, came the flu. Well, they called it the flu, but now you begin to think it was more of a plague, because it was killing people off like flies. And the school I was going to, which was Ballygawn at the time, no longer in existence, of course, that was closed from mid-December till I think about the first or second week in February. So I had plenty of time to be on the beach and enjoy every minute of it. Well, the cabin, as I said, was converted into the engine room. Two port bunks were taken out and the whole of the port side cleared, because the engine was going on the port side. The engine was a 9-horsepower Kelvin. Started on petrol, and after running for about 10 minutes on petrol, you switched over to paraffin. My word, it was cheap running in those days. Anyway, Mr. E.B. Christian, long since dead and gone, of course, but whose name is still carried on the chain of garages throughout the island, he had a small shop on the North Quay, Christian and Shaw Marine Engineers, and he came down to install the engine. Now, the road down to the beach is called the Harbour Road, and for a certain distance it's all right, but after that it's very dangerous for motor cars. I think the sign is still up to this day. Anyway, Mr. Christian got his old Ford Model T down to the shore all right, his old van. I think it carried a ton, really, but he made sure and brought the engine in, I think, two or three separate journeys, because it was quite heavy, you know, big crankcase, big flywheel, big cylinder block, all the parts, exhaust manifold, propeller shaft, propeller, gearbox. Well, it wasn't a gearbox as such, really. It was only a head, a stern, and neutral on it. But anyway, he got them all down to the beach quite safely with the old Model T Ford round this very bad corner, which is dangerous. And then he started, and of course I was his chief assistant, reveling every minute of it. Well, a big shear legs was rigged, and Mr. Christian had brought a chain block tackle down with him, and bit by bit, engine parts were lifted inboard into the cockpit. We'd already replaced the cockpit deck planks, and then he got to work in real earnest on the engine, and my word, he was a craftsman. I know I keep repeating this word craftsman, but in my very humble opinion, the men of those days were craftsmen. They took a pride in everything they did. The ploughman took a pride in his ploughing, the blacksmith took a pride in his work. The farmer, the fisherman, the stonemason, the engineer, even the length man, or I should say the man that did the high roads and kept the gutters clean and repaired the potholes and trimmed the hedges, the length man they called him then, he had a certain length of road to keep in order, and they all took a pride in their work. And I think it's through that hard work and the pride they took in it that the present society is affluent. Just my own humble opinion. Well, I'm getting to the end of this tape, and I've a lot more to tell you yet about Kitty and Garwick, lobster pot making, net making, so I'm afraid I'll have to go on to a second tape. I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope you have, really, as much as I've enjoyed making it. So if you have, well, you can have a go at the second tape when I get it complete. So for the present, lay my to y'all, and thank you very much.